Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 7th of December. This hour and next hour, we're going to be talking about income taxes and with a specific look at what happened on Wall Street, the second hour of our program today. As you well know, the tax cuts, President Obama did reach a deal with Republicans to extend all of the Bush-era income tax cuts. And we will be looking at that, which is fairly controversial among many Democrats. Is it good for the economy for this to happen? What about the extension of unemployment benefits? Would that have happened anyway? What about other aspects of this tax cut agreement, including continuing tax breaks for middle-class workers, childcare expenses and college costs, reducing the Social Security tax and exempting estates valued at $5 million for singles and $10 million for couples from a 35% tax. We've had our first guest on frequently, David K. Johnston. He knows more about taxes and the history of taxes in this country than anybody I know. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Hour number two of our program, Matt Taibbi was sick with a flu last week. He has rescheduled his appearance. He is author of Griftopia, Bubble Machines, Vampire Squids, and the Long Con That Is Breaking America. He admits that he knew very little about Wall Street and what happened with the collapse. And so he learned his material, and he learned it well, and he will be talking about how people have profited on Wall Street with the help of politicians in Washington. I think we're going to get a lot of phone calls this hour. Just have that feeling. What do you think? Our phone, Chrissy says, uh-huh, I think we are. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 is the number. And the email address is talk@wpr.org. Just a couple program notes, interesting shows coming up. Tomorrow at 10 o'clock, David Eisenhower will be with us. He's written a memoir of life with his grandfather, Dwight Eisenhower, 1961 to 1969. And Thursday at 10 o'clock, Walter Mondale will be with us. He's written a lovely memoir. So that's coming up future shows. And we begin with David. Hello, David. Thank you so much for being with us, our tax expert. We look to you all the time for advice. Nice to talk to you.
Well, Kathleen, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, a great pleasure. You wrote in a recent piece that poll after poll shows that less than 40% of Americans support extending the Bush tax cuts for all, and that support is highly concentrated among Republicans. With support so low, why was the deal reached yesterday?
Well, I think that's one of the great mysteries. And remember, this is only a deal between the president and the minority party. It is not a deal in which congressional Democrats have signed on. So this may be far from over. But I find this to be one of the most curious things about President Obama. As a candidate, he was remarkably eloquent. That may be influenced a little by the fact that some of the points he made seem to have come directly out of my books. But as a in office, he seems to be unwilling to display a lot of backbone. Frank Rich, my former colleague at the New York Times, in his column Sunday, referred to him as someone who's suffering from the Stockholm syndrome, you know, where you've been taken hostage, and when your captors do something nice to you, you do everything you can to please them. So hopefully they won't continue torturing or threatening you. And I find this, I understand his desire to overcome the excessive partisanship that has overtaken Washington in the last 30 years or so, partly because of the way we draw congressional districts, and in good part because of how we fund campaigns. But I'm mystified by his seeming inability to stand up for those things he articulated on the campaign trail as principles. That's certainly not a charge you can make, for example, against George Bush.
Right. Well, did he have any alternative but to say, I will not stand for this, I will veto this legislation, because he didn't have 60 votes and so he had to do this?
Absolutely. But let me deal with the 60 votes first.
Okay.
We do not have government by minority. Democracy is not government by minority. The 60 votes only occurs because some years ago, one of the Democrats who was the president of the leader of the Senate, the majority leader of the Senate, agreed to something called dual tracking. It used to be, if you remember the Jimmy Stewart movie, if you wanted to filibuster, you had to get on the floor and hold the floor. And as long as you kept talking or got someone to fill in for you, the floor was yours and all business stopped. Under this new system, you just say, well, I would take the floor, and all business on that bill stops. That's a perversion, to be polite about it, of this idea, and it grants any minority that only has 40 votes extraordinary power. I don't think it would be good for the Democrats or the Republicans. On the other issue, of course the president had other options. My column at tax.com is headlined, Call Their Bluff, Mr. President.
Right.
And I think that someone who's only half as eloquent as Barack Obama could say, if your position is unless the plutocrats get tax cuts, then no one gets them. You go right ahead. We'll let the tax cuts expire, the temporary Bush tax cuts that you could have made permanent when you controlled the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives, and did not do so, and put all of the onus for this on the Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe, frankly, that the Republicans are stupid enough to run that risk. But even if, you know, I'm wrong about that, Congress can retroactively enact tax law. The Supreme Court ruled on that as recently as 1994, and President Bush signed a retroactive tax increase, something he vowed he'd never increase on taxes on anybody. In 2006, he signed a law that retroactively raised taxes on teenagers, putting many of them who had savings accounts or some of whom had actually worked and earned the money into higher tax brackets with their college funds when they went to go to college. So, the president absolutely could have said, I'm going to stick to my principles, and if you feel that you need to stick to yours, go right ahead and we'll see what happens. He just doesn't seem to have the fortitude to do that sort of thing.
Now, could this have been taken up some time ago, and if so, why wasn't it? When he had everybody in the House, and he had...
Yes, well, I'm trying to remember the word for putting off till tomorrow. I want to say...
Right.
It's a natural human tendency to work against deadline. But I think that's a very good point. I mean, I think that the Obama administration, when it first took office, and you have supposedly have your honeymoon period, although in his case he really didn't get one, probably should have focused first on the economy and taxes and then on health care. Instead, the president went for this, you know, very complicated Republican-style health plan. Remember, the health plan we got was very much patterned after Republican proposals, and achieved, therefore, only a small fraction of what he had promised when he ran. And the estate tax issue, for example, we've known this is coming for some time, and no action was taken even to deal with the exemption this year, where we've seen a number of billionaires now die with untaxed fortunes. Remember, most of the money subject to the estate tax has never been taxed. It is unrealized capital gains.
Hmm.
And so we have huge fortunes that have never been taxed that have been passed forward. Now, they are subject mostly to being taxed if and when they're sold, but whether the full and proper tax will be collected is dubious because we don't have the record-keeping mechanisms for the government to police that.
Let's go back to the congressional Democrats. Probably Senator Bernie Sanders has been the most outspoken on all of this. He said that he would do whatever he could to block the tax deal. Senator Tom Harkin from Iowa a few days ago said that the president is in trouble in terms of reelection if he lets these tax cuts continue for those who are very wealthy. Tell me more about what you think the president's going to run into in trying to get congressional Democrats behind this deal.
Well, that, you know, I've made it a point my whole career, Kathleen, to not be in Washington and break stories about Washington from Los Angeles or New York or where I live now in Rochester, New York. So politics is not my strong suit. But imagine for a moment you're one of the, I think it's 21 Democrats in the Senate who will be up for election in 2012. You have a president who does not display leadership. If you stand up for sound tax policy in any way that the Republicans don't like, you will be targeted. There's no question you will be targeted. So that's got to be an incredibly inhibiting factor in terms of how you're going to view this. And the Citizens United decision that allows unlimited secret corporate spending on campaigns is a part of this. Citizens United is to the expansion of corporate political power as the Big Bang was to the singularity. It is the whole universe. And I think, therefore, you're not going to see anything but some tweaking on the edges by the Senate Democrats before some kind of a resolution is reached. Mm.
Senator Mitch McConnell has said repeatedly that you simply, in a bad economy, cannot raise taxes. It's just not during a recession. It is simply not good for the economy.
Well, you know, throughout history, we've raised taxes. Wisconsin raised taxes in the past during recessions. Iowa, Michigan, when I was there, did it. You know, government services that make the economy function, if you cut them, make us worse off. Now, that's not to argue there isn't a lot of things we could be doing differently about government. There are. But, for example, there's a brand-new study out in Pennsylvania that shows that not maintaining the highways and roads in that state is costing billions of dollars a year in everything from front-end alignments to accidents to slower movement of goods and services. There is no free lunch here. So the idea that you can't raise taxes in a recession is ridiculous. And let me also point out, we raised taxes in the 90s during the George H.W. Bush and Clinton administrations, both of those administrations. And over time, more and more jobs were created. We cut taxes at the beginning of the Bush administration. Fewer jobs were created during the Bush administration than during the Eisenhower administration when we were a much smaller country. Median wage went down at the end of the Bush administration. It was lower. In 2009, it was lower than it was in 2000. Average wages grew a tiny fraction of 1%, 0.9% after all those years. And even though the population of the country grew 10%, the income tax brought in less money than it did in the year 2000. So all of the premises of tax cuts, it will result in higher incomes, more investment, more jobs, and more government revenue, have not proven to be true since the year 2000. And that should cause us to say, well, wait a minute, the evidence doesn't support this policy, so what kind of policy will best serve our country?
The other part of this was an extension of jobless benefits for 13 months. Would that have happened anyway?
Some kind of extension probably would have occurred. I find the 13-month thing to be very curious because, you know, we have almost 10% unemployment. And when you then add all the people who are underemployed, that is, they want to work full-time but can't find full-time work, or who cannot find any work at all, and the evidence shows that those people are over 50, they may never find any kind of work again. What good does the 13-month extension do? Now, you'll notice Social Security has had a spike in spending. That's because lots of people who are disabled but continue working, which is the normal pattern, people who are disabled, if they can work, do, have started applying for disability benefits because they're not old enough for Social Security and they have no income or prospect of income in the future. So 13 months, just it strikes me as a curious policy, and what we really ought to be doing is working on policies that encourage job creation in America. At the same time, Kathleen, this is going on. The president is now pushing this quote-unquote free trade agreement with Korea. The government says it will create zero jobs if you look at the government's data. And the Economic Policy Institute, which is a liberal economic policy research group in Washington, they say that it will have a net destruction of 159,000 jobs in America, and the tariff on goods we send to Korea will continue to be twice what it would be on goods brought to the United States. So if those assumptions are correct, the Obama administration is asking for 13 months more unemployment benefits with no prospect that there'll be jobs at the end of it for people, and is pursuing policies that will destroy more jobs.
Mm. What about this? You mentioned in your recent Call Their Bluff, Mr. President, the Making Work Pay tax credit, which most people don't know anything about. What is that, and how does that figure in?
That's an amazing example of how the president, as a president, seems to just assume if he does something, everybody will know about it. 95% of Americans 98% of Americans who have a job got $400 if you're a married couple, $800 tax credit in 2009 and 2010 that reduced the tax burden. That's why so many additional people are not paying federal income taxes currently. Remember, Sarah Palin made a big deal out of 44% of us aren't paying any income taxes. It's because of that Mike Work pay credit. The Republicans have said they have no interest in continuing this. Now, I would imagine Lyndon Johnson or Bill Clinton would have said, so the Republicans are really the party of raising taxes on working people. They don't want to continue this because they had no interest in it. Obama has just said, okay, fine, you don't want it, I'll give it up, we'll do something else. And the proposal is instead to have this temporary reduction in the payroll tax that funds Social Security. And remember, Social Security is the only program in America with a dedicated federal tax, and with minor tweaks, 0.3% of GDP over the next 75 years, it would be solvent. And if we had the same rate of job growth and income growth we had prior to 1980 in this country, going back 170 years, just excluding the last 30, we would have plenty of money to fund Social Security. So what's happening with that proposal is a further weakening of Social Security finances that will inevitably add to pressure that we should reduce Social Security benefits, delay them, and take other actions that will hurt the vast majority of Americans in their old age.
No surprise, all four phone lines have been blinking ever since we announced you were going to be on the air, so we'll start taking phone calls momentarily. We're talking about the agreement that has been reached, a deal on the tax cuts, and there are other parts of this. Most of you are quite familiar with it, I'm sure. David K. Johnston is our guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. He also has, for those of you who are interested in tax policy, a highly interesting website. It's tax.com, the tax daily for the citizen taxpayer, which if you want more information, more analysis of what's going on from his point of view, and also a history lesson in what taxes used to be in this country, David knows his stuff. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Give yourselves a minute before you call in because our lines are filled. We'll start taking your calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, Matt Taibbi will be with us. His latest book is Griftopia, Bubble Machines, Vampire Squids, and the Long Con That is Breaking America. He looks at the rise, fall, and rescue of Wall Street in the bubble and bailout era and says that this was the coming out party for the network of looters who sit at the nexus of American political and economic power with help from our politicians. Tomorrow at 10 o'clock, David Eisenhower will be with us. He is the grandson of Ike, President Eisenhower, author of Coming Home to Glory, a memoir of life with the president from 61 to 69. And we will also speak with Walter Mondale on Thursday at 10 o'clock. Good shows coming up, including this show is a good, interesting show, don't you think? Let's start our calls. Mike from Three Lakes. Hi, Mike. Mike, are you there? Mike? I'm not sure what's going on here. Let's try. We'll put you on hold in case you walked away from your phone. Jim from West Dallas. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Professor, I would concede that tax cuts do provide additional disposable income and therefore can stimulate the economy, but only up to a point. It's been nearly 40 years since I took my last economics course in grad school, but I believe they're still teaching something called diminishing returns. And I'm asking, are you familiar with that principle? And do you agree that there is the point of diminishing returns does have an impact in terms of how much tax cuts can stimulate the economy?
Oh, Jim, I think you're exactly correct about that. And in fact, the Congressional Budget Office did a study of 11 different options for dealing with our current problem, which is a lack of demand. The definition of a recession is that there's not enough demand and ability to buy goods and services to keep the economy going. And of the 11 options they examined, far and away dead last was tax cuts. particularly high income tax cuts, because people at the top save their money, and there's a significant amount of evidence that they are putting their money into three areas, none of which are protective of the economy. Very low return savings instruments, because many of them are risk averse and concerned about the future. Investing in creating jobs overseas, because they get lower wage rates and therefore higher returns on capital. And speculation, heavily supported with borrowed money, typically at a ratio of 30 borrowed dollars to each invested dollar, through hedge funds. So no question that particularly tax cuts on high-income people. And remember, the president's proposal to eliminate the Bush tax cuts for people at 200 married couples at $250,000 above, singles at $200,000, was $200,000 of taxable income. That's not your total income. That really means people whose incomes are over about $400,000 a year, so you're well into the top 1%.
Unless you had more. Jim, do you have more?
No, I'm glad that the professor agrees with that principle. It just seems to me that you did say one thing about saving the high-income earners saving their disposable income. I would contend that it's really their money is being invested in the stock market, and that's what's creating the increase in the stock market, which is really all funny money anyhow. I mean, and sooner or later, it's all going to come crashing down again.
Well, that I wouldn't agree with you about. I mean, in the long run, if businesses produce profits, then stock values will rise. The problem is that over any 30-year period, of the top 500 stocks, the majority of them will actually produce losses. The reason that the idea of buying index funds has gained a lot of popularity is you don't know who the winners and losers are. If you're a full-time, very talented, in the market with lots of information trader, you can make a lot of money in the market. If you're you or me living out in the provinces, unless we buy index funds, we are actually more likely to lose money over a long period of time than make money in real terms, because the gains are concentrated in a relatively small number of companies.
Thanks very much for the call. Can you refresh us what the gap is right now and where it compares historically between the very high-income workers in this country and everybody else?
Yeah, let me give you a couple of, I think, very important numbers. Between 2005 and 2007, 30% of all the increased income in America went to the 1 in 400 Americans who makes over $1 million a year. That's incredibly highly concentrated. Since 1980, the average income of the bottom 90% of Americans, what I call the vast majority, has increased by $303. That is, it's hardly gone up at all.
Oh,
and since 2000, it's fallen by $3,000, or about 9%. But the top 1/100th of 1%, now that's a tiny group of people. It's only a little over 30,000 Americans, a little under 15,000 households. Their income has gone up more than fivefold, to $27 million on average. So if you're in the bottom 90%, you have essentially a dollar and a penny for each dollar you had in 1980. If you're in the top 1/100th of 1%, you have over $5 for each dollar you had back then, and that group's income has grown from a penny out of every dollar in the whole country to almost 6 cents. Out of every dollar in the whole country. So 99.99% of us used to get 99% of the income. Now we get about 94.5% of the income.
Is this comparable to any other time in history?
Well, if we had really good data for the late 1800s, when the Industrial Revolution took place in America, and we had a similar period of a long social and economic panic, yes, I think we would have some similarities in that. In the 1920s, we had quite similar results, which led, I would argue, in large part, to the results in the Depression. Right now, the top 1% of Americans are making more than 20% of the income. Back in 1980, they made less than 10% of the income. And in the peak year, 2007, the top 1% made 23.5% of all the income in the country. All the reported income in the country. That's a very important phrase, reported, because there are lots of people who legally have huge incomes and are not required to report them under the tax system.
Right. Kathy in Waupaca. Hi.
Hi. Great show. You know, this was a time when Obama should have played political hardball, and again, he whiffed. It really bothers me that they speak of the threat of filibuster like it means the cosmic order would collapse if Republicans filibustered. Why not make them do it? What is the worst thing that could happen, except they could use this and say, now look who's being obstructionist. Look who's the problem. And they fail to do that every time. What is the political, I hate to call it a game, but I think to most of them it really is a game. What kind of game are they playing?
Well, Kathy, I have to say that having read a lot of other people's writing on this, it's pretty clear that the way you and I see this is a minority view. The conventional wisdom in Washington is that if the president called the Republicans bluff, he would be the one who would be blamed for everybody's taxes going up on January 1st, and the Democrats would be blamed, and the Republicans would turn this into, see, everybody's taxes went up, that's what the Democrats really want, instead of the way you and I see it, which is, no, your taxes went up because billionaires were unwilling to pay higher taxes. So that we could reduce the deficit. I think that a lot of this has to do with the nature of President Obama's history. When he was at Harvard, there was a big fight over who was going to control the law review. The most prestigious thing for students to do is be in the law review, and he was the editor of the Harvard Law Review. And if you're a law student, that is the most prestigious position in all of America. And when he became the compromise candidate, the people he appointed to the prestigious positions at the Harvard Law Review turned out to be, I believe, all of them white. And by the way, there's only another one person in the White House staff who's not white besides the president. That's Valerie Jarrett. And a number of them turned up as high-level appointees later in the George W. Bush administration. So in many ways, the history of Barack Obama is one of a compromise and progress for his own career through promoting the interests of people who don't share his social his views about society.
Hmm. You could also say, though, couldn't you, that he took obviously a huge walloping in the midterm elections, and he read those as, I have to compromise now, or the American people will be furious with me. There has to be a spirit of bipartisanship.
I agree with you about that, Kathleen. And he has been, ever since he started running for office, remember, he really only spent 2 years as a senator before he started running, he has pushed this notion that he's the uniter. What he's gotten in return from the Republicans has been, you know, our agenda and our way or the highway, and it hasn't changed his behavior. I don't think what most people expected when Barack Obama was elected. By the way, can I go back and just correct one thing?
Yeah.
Tax.com is not my website. The nonprofit charity Tax Analyst, which was created to increase public knowledge and understanding and transparency of the tax system, runs that site. I work for their publications and persuade them to put some of my columns up at tax.com. And one of them that's up there right now is all about a very interesting lawsuit involving the S.C. Johnson Company in
Wisconsin,
state,
yes.
And allegations that they engaged in numerous tax frauds, which they vigorously deny. But I did get the head of the company to acknowledge that they did things that do not meet the standards of the company. And that's a very interesting case because the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago has ordered that a lawyer be appointed for the whistleblower to make sure he's fully represented. And this is a civil action. Very extraordinary, unusual, and interesting case at tax.com.
Huh. All right. We'll look into that. Let's go next to, thanks, Kathy, for your call. John in Milwaukee. Hi.
I have two suggestions. One suggestion for conservatives for reducing taxes or reducing spending, excuse me. And then one for liberals for increasing revenues. The suggestion for reducing spending would be, there used to be quite a bit of talk of a line item veto, and I suggest that the conservatives push through a line item veto. And if that the Tea Party was serious about reducing spending, they would offer President Obama a line item veto, but they seem to be silent on that. Then my suggestion for increasing revenues is about 25 or 30 years ago when I first started buying stocks. If I bought $1,000 worth of stock, it would probably have cost me about $70, $80. And that price due to computers and internet has been reduced to virtually nothing, I think under $9 now. So my suggestion is, if you look at the volume that went on in the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ, they're up to dramatically up to about 6 billion shares a day. And I just sold some real estate recently, and I'll have to pay capital gains on it, but not only will I pay capital gains, but I'll pay a transfer tax. And my suggestion is that if you look at that 10 billion shares that are traded every day on the NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange, if we put in a tenth or a hundredth of a percent of a transfer fee, it would reduce the speculative swings that you see in the stock market, and it could raise up to several hundred billion dollars a year, and it would be insignificant. I mean, 25 or 30 years ago, I was paying $75 on a $1,000 purchase,
right,
and now I'm paying under $9. So if you added a tenth of a percent transfer fee on that, it would be insignificant.
David.
Well, the proposal John is bringing up is called the Tobin tax. It's named for a late professor at Yale who's shown that a tiny, tiny transfer tax on stocks would bring in an enormous amount of money. The response of the Wall Street trading crowd is, fine, we'll just move to the stock market, since it's all computerized, to servers over in Bermuda, and you won't collect a penny. I'm not sure that they could be quite as successful as they think, but it is a very significant, interesting idea. Most of this trading, it's important to understand, is done with borrowed money, which means at the end of the day, you and I are at risk. And it is done with computers to do these split-second buying and selling to capture a penny here and a nickel there, and you do enough of that, you can make yourself billions of dollars. The on the line item veto, you know, neither party wants it because they know what the other party will do when they're in power. And you know, remember what Plato said, that the democracy means to rule and to be ruled in turns. And, well, you might want your party to have the line item veto. You don't want the other party to have it when it's their turn to rule.
A line is open right now if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. David K. Johnston is our guest. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, worked for the New York Times covering tax policy. He's author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. And he appears frequently on tax.com, the tax daily for the citizen taxpayer. Our next call is Mike from Three Lakes. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. Sorry I got cut off a while ago. Mr. Johnston, I've got several of your books, and I'm impressed. The only thing I have to disagree with you about most heartily is your representation this morning about the potential limits of stupidity of Republicans. However, I have a question. Isn't it quite possible to actually calculate for the next 2 years what this extension of tax relief will be for those making more than $250,000?
Oh, and sure, and we'll get
isn't
those
it possible
numbers
to
probably
tell
today
what
or
that
tomorrow
is
from the Joint Committee on Taxation
and the debt?
Wait, we had
and I'll listen off the air.
All right, we had two people talking at once. David,
I apologize. I thought I thought Mike was finished. We'll get the numbers that Mike wants in the next day or so. From the Joint Committee on Taxation, which is the official scorekeeper. I mean, we have a lot of good estimates now. Roughly, the tax cuts for the top 2% are about $60 billion right now. So that means the government's going to borrow another roughly $60 billion to cover that portion of it. The 10-year cost of extending, and this is only a two-year deal, but the 10-year cost of extending the Bush tax cuts would be $4 trillion of additional borrowing. And it would mean that the President Obama's budget projections, which show the deficits getting smaller, in fact, Obama's first deficit is smaller than Bush's last deficit, that would not take place. And the problem with that is, as another column I have at tax.com points out on what I call Undertaxed Freedom Day, if interest rates right now went back to the level of the year 2000, all of the income taxes you paid until December 3rd of this year, I believe it is, would have just equaled interest on the national debt. So if you put another $4 trillion on it just to finance tax cuts. Basically, all the income taxes that come out of your paycheck just go to cover interest on the national debt. It goes to wealthy people, insurance companies, banks, and China.
So is there a way to realistically lower the debt, which we've heard so much about, without changing your tax policy? Or government spending, can it be cut enough to make a dent in the deficit, or are we not going to hear anything about the deficit anymore?
Well, this will be very interesting. You know, when I was growing up, and I'm going to be 62 this month,
happy birthday.
What I always heard was that the Democrats were the party of fiscal irresponsibility. That seems to have changed in more modern times. But I suspect we'll hear a lot less about the deficit, certainly on Fox News, and a lot more about how what we need are more tax cuts, that the solution to everything is tax cuts. As the infrastructure falls apart, as we cut, we are now in a position where illnesses from foodborne illnesses for lack of safety inspections are, I think it's three times the rate they are in Britain and seven times in France, because we've so radically cut spending on that. That's what spending cuts mean. They'll mean more deaths, more illnesses, people dying sooner, more damage to things like your car, or if you're a business owner, the truck that moves your goods around the country, because we're not investing in the common goods which are necessary for private wealth creation.
Thanks, Mike, for your call. Jim in Appleton, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to endorse the president's compromise. I think the president has a very special role. He has to be more than just an advocate for his party. He has to lead the entire nation. And I think this compromise on taxes is evidence that he's moving towards the center and representing all of us, and I endorse that.
David?
Well, I mean, I think that's a perfectly reasonable way to look at this. The problem is that this is not, I don't think this is moving towards the center. This is heavily weighted toward people at the very top who, after all, they are able to be, the reason you can become wealthy in America is the society enables that. That's the principle the ancient Athenians figured out that led them to create democracy, which was the child of the invention of the moral basis of progressive taxation. And the president clearly sees himself as someone whose job is to bring us together. But is he really bringing us together, or is he simply deferring an immediate fight because he doesn't have the stomach for it, without considering the long-term consequences?
I want to talk to David about unemployment rates, too, which are almost 10% in this country. It's very hard to be without a job, and I'm wondering what kind of tax policy could be designed to lower that rate, to find people work, which I think a lot of people are asking for. So we'll get to that. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. David K. Johnston is our guest. We're talking this hour about the deal that was reached on the tax cuts, and we are welcoming emails, too. We don't have any of those, but we could do that if you want to send one. It's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Matt Taibbi is with us, the second hour of our program. His latest book is Griftopia. And we go back to phone calls. John in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you, first of all, for the wonderful public service that you and Rhonda and Chrissy do by your amazing show with your great guests. I just wanted to thank you for that.
Thanks, John.
I had two quick questions for the professor. The first is, I noticed, just doing a little simple math in my head, that if this compromise goes through, the tax cuts, the 2 years, will be, you know, we'll probably be rehashing this same debate around the timing of the 2012 presidential election. So my first question is, you know, in your opinion, does that mean that we're, you know, that it'll be an easier path for Republicans to get another extension of these tax cuts, you know, because Barack Obama won't want to be painted as, you know, a taxing president or whatever in time for his reelection campaign? That's my first question. And my second question is, I feel like we really need to have a national conversation in this country that no one in politics wants to have, because it's not convenient. We want all of these great services, you know, and education and regulated food and infrastructure and stuff, but we don't want to have to pay the taxes that are required to finance those. And I'm really worried about the future, because, you know, are we going to keep borrowing ourselves, you know, into oblivion so that we can pretend that taxes are low? You know, what are your predictions for the future? I guess those are my two questions.
Thank you, John.
Well, if we keep borrowing money in the long run, we will end up in a real financial catastrophe. In the short run, right now, where we have lack of demand, government borrowing is, economic theory anyway, suggests that this is the most important thing government can be doing right now, making up for this lack of demand. And the analogy I would make is, imagine that you are married and you just bought a house because you're expecting a baby, and you have two used cars because you both have jobs, and both cars break down and are unrepairable. Do you go into debt further to buy more cars? Or do you say, well, can't take on any more debt, that would be irresponsible? Of course not. You go and buy two cars so that you can continue to earn a living and pay for the house and raise your child. And that's the way we should be looking at this. We are rapidly turning the federal government into simply a transfer payment system where interest is paid to the wealthiest people and large institutions and the Chinese government out of our pockets. And you asked the question earlier, Kathleen, about taxes and job creation.
Yes.
When the tax rate is only 15% on dividends, you are encouraging the owners of businesses to withdraw money and spend it for their personal benefit. If you have a much higher tax rate on withdrawal from your business, let me just pick a number we used to have, 50% under Reagan during his early years, you discourage that kind of withdrawal. Money withdrawn from businesses is job destruction. In addition, we have a whole host of policies, subsidies, tax deferrals, and other policies that say to people who run businesses, if you can move your jobs to China or another place where a week's wages are equal to an hour's wages here, do it. And so we are subsidizing both directly and indirectly job destruction rather than job creation. It turns out, according to one of the leading advocates of quote-unquote free trade, Danny Roderick, a professor at Harvard, that the current free trade agreements we have will cause our gross domestic product in the year 2025, 15 years from now, to be larger by one-tenth of 1%.
Well, David, how did we get from there to here?
Well, this is all, I contend, the result of Milton Friedman and the Chicago School. Milton Friedman, remember, wanted to close all public parks because any public park is the violent, coercive use of state power for socialistic purposes. Or, as I like to put it, if a child doesn't have money for a ticket, they can't play on a swing. He promoted this idea that we are not a nation. We're not a society. We are simply several hundred million people who live in the same geography. And I think that it's very clear, at least in my mind, and I understand people could reasonably disagree about this, that one of the reasons we have been so wealthy and so successful is that we understood that the Commonwealth comes first, and that by expanding the Commonwealth, building infrastructure and education and training and research, that we then can enable this enormous private wealth creation. And we've lost sight of that. We've totally lost sight of that. And we've also gotten this idea that unregulated markets are a good thing. I mean, we have the chief judge in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals is co-author of a textbook that says there's no need for fraud statutes in securities markets. And many of our policies dealing with markets now are operating on the theory that the people who run companies and markets are only interested in building up the enterprise. Well, how much more evidence do we need that a number of our big enterprises, including several of the big banks involved in the mortgage scandal, were not being run for the benefit of the enterprise? They were being run for the benefit of the executive, whose behavior, if this were the SNL scandal of the 80s, would have resulted in criminal indictments. Remember, there were 1,000 felony convictions in the SNL scandal. There hasn't been a single prosecution in the meltdown on Wall Street, because the FBI announced that it was partnering with the banking industry. And the banking industry says the only frauds that took place here were by consumers.
Oh, my
no
gosh.
No fraud at all by the banking industry.
No, of course.
And that's the official policy of our government.
John, thanks very much for your call. Bill in Oshkosh, hi.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for some sense at last. I have a principle that I was taught in the school was that a rising tide lifts all boats. And I think that's relevant to this, the question of what do the rich do with their tax savings as opposed to what the poor do. And I wish to turn it as an example toward health policy. If, looking at development overseas, which may not apply here, the best way to raise your GDP is to invest in health. The classic town pump discovery that was made in England about cholera, that if you fix the water supply, everybody benefits hugely. The Commonwealth leaps and bounds benefits from that kind of stroke. Why has that not been mentioned in the health care debate? And I think it's parallel to these tax issues. When you can look at the multiplier of private spending that would be created by a healthier population, working longer, demanding more goods and services, why wouldn't that in time exponentially raise the GDP, which would easily, or not easily, but would in time more than cover the cost of healthcare expansion?
Well, the caller makes a very good point, Kathleen. The single biggest thing we could do to promote economic growth in America is to get rid of our business-for-profit model for health care or sick care. We're spending 5 percentage points of GDP more than we need to right now to have a Cadillac health care system. And we're going to be spending 20% of our economy in a couple of years and 25% in about 15 years on health care if we continue down the road that we're down. And the caller is quite right that we are losing sight of these ideas, like the famous hand pump example, where it turned out that if you just cleaned up the water, public health has been an enormous economic benefit to the country. If you just cleaned up the water, cholera went away. And it was done by simply mapping how people got sick in connection to a single pump where everybody was touching the pump and picking up the bugs that gave people cholera.
Goodness. Thank you very much, Bill, for your call. Laverne in DeForest. Hi, Laverne.
Yeah, good morning. I was curious, what do you think is enough for the government to confiscate if 35% on the top earners isn't enough? How much would be enough for all the people that suck at the teat of the federal government? You know, what is your idea of fairness? By the way, the federal government will accept, gifts. So all of those of you out there that think that the federal government or any other part of government isn't wasting enough of your money, go ahead and send in as much as you'd like.
What do you think they're wasting, Laverne?
What do I think they're wasting?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, let's see. Do you have a clue what the Constitution of the United States says? The federal government is there to have an army to protect its citizens. The majority of the stuff that the federal government does is probably technically unconstitutional. If people weren't so dumb as to send all their money to the federal government, and problems that we had in our individual states, and we could take care of our problems ourselves in our individual states, just think of the money that we could save.
David.
Well, Laverne represents a very widely held view in this country, so let me deal with a couple of key points. First of all, we had much greater economic growth when we had higher tax rates. I know that seems counterintuitive, but the reason for that is that business owners kept reinvesting in the business rather than withdrawing money, and that seems to be crucial to that, number one. Number two, who is it who's getting all this money from the government? I hope that Bill reads my book, Free Lunch. It is principally very wealthy people and corporations. States give away $70 billion a year to corporations through things like building factories for them. Verizon is about to get money from the state of New York for a new facility near Buffalo. It will cost $3.4 million per job. The average job pays $40,000 at this facility. Figure out how many years, it's more than a lifetime, people would have to work to recoup that investment. But let me go to the most important point Laverne makes.
We have about 30 seconds.
What does the Constitution say? We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Promoting the general welfare is one of the six noble purposes of the Constitution, and we've lost sight of that, and Laverne is one of the people who has blinded himself to that very point. Promoting the general welfare is a founding principle under our Constitution.
David, thank you so much for being with us, as always. We appreciate your knowledge.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks, David. David K. Johnston, he is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the New York Times, where he spent many years writing about taxes in this country and history of taxes. He's author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. And you can find his writings frequently on tax.com, a very interesting website. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up, and we'll return with more talk about money and who's got it and how they got it.